The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com and kidspiritonline.com. Our first article today is from teenvogue.com. Sasheen Little Feather, Native American actress and activist, dies at 75. She leaves behind an incredible legacy. And this article was written by Caitlin McNabb. On October 2nd, Sasheen Little Feather died at age 75. News of her passing was announced by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences on Sunday evening. Sasheen Little Feather was a Native American actress, model, and activist who is famously known for representing actor Marlon Brando at the 1973 Academy Awards. At that year's ceremony, he was awarded the Best Actor Prize for his work in The Godfather. Sasheen, who was 26 at the time, made a speech on his behalf, declining the award while dressed in traditional Apache regalia. The speech Sasheen read was intended to bring awareness to the harmful treatment of Native Americans in the film industry and the standoff happening at the time between the federal government and Native American activists protesting and occupying Wounded Knee, South Dakota, the site of an 1890 massacre of around 300 Lakota people by the U.S. Army. Sasheen was met with mixed reactions from the crowd, prompting cheers, boos, and shocked faces. "I beg at this time that I have not intruded upon this evening, and that we will, in the future, our hearts and our understandings will meet with love and generosity," Sasheen said at the time. She never finished the full speech. According to one of the ceremony's producers, actor John Wayne had to be restrained by security guards as to not storm the stage. Sasheen's act at the 1973 Oscars helped bring media attention to the cause, but she was harshly criticized afterwards and effectively blacklisted in Hollywood. Just last month, Sasheen received a long-overdue formal apology from the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. They held a reflective event honoring her, called An Evening with Sasheen Little Feather. "I was stunned. I never thought I'd live to see the day I would be hearing this, experiencing this," Sasheen told The Hollywood Reporter of receiving the apology. "When I was at the podium in 1973, I stood there alone." With only 60 seconds at the Oscars podium, Sasheen impacted Hollywood forever. But her legacy includes even more acts of bravery, even more triumphs of her activism. Sasheen was among the first occupiers of Alcatraz Island to protest broken treaties. She became a producer, winning an Emmy in 1984 for her advisory work on a PBS special. She was a staff member of the American Indian Center, AIC. She was co-founder of the American Indian Registry for Performing Arts, and she co-founded the American Indian AIDS Institute of San Francisco. In their tribute post to the activist, the Academy shared that Sasheen died at her home in Novato, California, and included a graphic of her alongside a quote from her. "When I am gone, always be reminded that whenever you stand for your truth, you will be keeping my voice and the voices of our nations and our people alive." And our next articles come from kidspiritonline.com. Our next article, Thinking Your Way to the Top. And this article was written by Abdullah Sayed. "My sister, she was always logically oriented," my seventh grade music teacher, Miss Nicholas, once mused to my class. "So, of course, she went into mathematics. Me, well, I've always been a bit more free-minded, and here I am," Miss Nicholas continued. The perception that fields of study rely solely on either logical thinking or creative thinking is a common cliché. Creative minds are purported to be writers, artists, or musicians, whereas their logical counterparts are scientists and mathematicians. This way of thinking is flawed because it undercuts the value that creativity offers us in the modern age and has offered us since the inception of society. In fact, creativity remains essential in unexpected ways today. Creativity and logic are both vague terms. There are hundreds of perfectly acceptable ways to interpret these amorphous concepts. However, for the purposes of this discussion, we will try to frame them in generally accepted terms. Creativity is the ability to create novel ideas from existing inspirations. In other words, it is the ability to take what already exists and combine it with other existing sources of inspiration in an unprecedented way. Logic is the ability to arrive at conclusions or deductions based on known information. Ever since the age of rationalism was born out of the works of Enlightenment-era thinkers, we, as a global society, have sought to understand our world through logic. From economics to the origin of humanity, we have used reason to divine the nature of the universe. Of course, we have much to show for this way of thinking. The technological advancements of the last few centuries are evidence of this. However, this story leaves out the critical role that creativity has played in our progress and the role that it will continue to play in the future. Sonar and radar were first developed during the World Wars as a way to detect enemy submarines and airplanes in the water and air, respectively. Today, advancements are being made in this technology through an unlikely source: research conducted on bats and dolphins' use of echolocation. Both sonar and radar rely on similar physics as those employed by these animals. This is an excellent example of creative application in a traditionally logical field. Scientists observed the techniques employed by animals and combined it with a seemingly unrelated concept. Examples of these kinds of approaches are abundant today. Slime molds have been used to improve Tokyo's transportation system, while sharks are studied to give American Olympic athletes an edge in water sports. Critically, creativity is fundamental to all fields, regardless of whether it appears in the form of an artist's masterpiece or an extraordinary scientific accomplishment. However, creativity can take different forms. Previously, creativity was defined as the ability to produce novel ideas. When creative ideas are applied to the real world and cause a significant change in conventional ways of thinking or doing things, they can be described as innovative. Our society runs on these innovations. In today's age, creativity is in short supply. This has to do with the nature of creativity and the nature of our economy. Before we explore that topic, however, an important implication of our definition of creativity has to be defined. This is the fact that theoretically, everyone has equal opportunity to be creative. This has been known for millennia. As stated in the Bible, there is nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes 1:9. Every single innovation that has been made by humanity was based on something that already existed previously. In other words, the inspirations through which creative thoughts or innovations can emerge are hypothetically available to everyone. Anyone can look at the night sky and write a poem describing it. However, only few people can produce such a poem that might be recognized for their originality. As many of us who have been given a vague writing prompt or had to create an original piece of art in school know, Even though all the pieces may lie in front of us, it is difficult to arrange our thoughts and what we understand with our senses into new configurations. Thus, though everyone might have equal opportunity to be creative, not everyone has equal capability to be creative. Most of us have spent almost all our lives in some form of schooling with the hope that our education will give us the means to secure a well-paying job as adults. Though all of our circumstances are different, it is true that in order to achieve the greatest material success, we will have to be more innovative than previous generations. The U.S. economy is a market economy. The market rewards those who are able to conduct business with the greatest productivity. Productivity is always increased through innovations. For instance, whether a pharmaceutical company invents a new drug for a previously incurable illness, or a baker finds a way to bake bread more cheaply than his competitors, their innovation is rewarded by the free market. This means that, regardless of the field you enter, you must also always be creative to be the most successful. Furthermore, the United States economy has become increasingly service-oriented in the last half century. This is a trend present in markets overseas as well. Gone are the well-paid manufacturing jobs that supported the U.S. economy throughout the 19th century up until the mid-20th century. The consequence of this is that low-skilled jobs that require little to no creativity have disappeared. Where they still exist, they do not pay nearly as well as they did in decades past. Therefore, the American market is becoming increasingly reliant on more creative occupations. Of course, no one operates like a computer without an iota of creativity, just as no one lives on simply creative impulses. However, creative thinking is in many ways the unsung hero that has led humanity to where it is now. In the 21st century, the changing economy has given us new reasons to seek out a creative mindset. Whether you aspire to be a doctor or a writer, recognize that your success may be contingent upon your ability to bring innovation to your field. And our next article, Should We Serve Nature or Should Nature Serve Us? This article was written by Fiza Raza. The earliest records of history show that nature, in all its shapes and forms, has served humanity, from rocks used as hunting tools to fruit used as sustenance. Humankind has always looked to nature for survival. This is not a dependency confined to ancient times. It seeps into our everyday lives, too. Industries, households, and entire societies are powered solely on what nature offers us, be it water, coal, electricity, or energy in any form. Upon closer inspection, this seems rather odd. Human beings are, above all, characterized as fiercely independent and progressive. In fact, as the most intelligent species to colonize the planet, how is it then that humanity, this remarkable species, depends entirely on nature for its survival? Perhaps even greater cause for indignation, how is it that we are destroying the very thing responsible for our survival and continued progression? Whether or not humans have a right to exploit nature, our survival depends on its survival. As the only species capable of saving the environment, we must now work to serve its interests in more ways. Do we, as a species, deserve nature? Should it really serve us? Is the fact that human beings are able to use nature for our betterment enough to give us the inherent right to exploit it? Let us first examine the lines that define nature and humanity. In some ways, the two cannot be distinguished from one another. Humanity comes from nature, is both a product of natural forces as a living creature, and depends on it for sustenance. But the line between the two becomes increasingly clear if we view their relationship through the lens of what separates humanity from other living creations, intelligence. Mankind's intelligence and ability to use natural creations to its advantage clearly distinguish the two. Animals, or other beings with semi-autonomy, all constitute greater parts of nature than we do. Because of our ability to think and use what exists naturally, modify it, and make greater creations. However, it is this same ability that we have misused in the recent past. If we look at nature as a sentient being, capable of making decisions, almost all logical arguments would conclude that nature should not continue to serve us. It has become an increasingly paradoxical relationship that we share with nature. While nature has always served as a safe haven for humans, from prehistoric times when our ancestors would use the protection of trees to escape predators, we have been the single greatest cause of its destruction. Large-scale deforestation and industrial pollution are just a few examples. Perhaps we do not deserve nature and all it has to offer. Should nature continue to serve us, independent of whether or not that is of benefit to nature? We should ask if we have an inherent right over nature, simply because humanity has been intelligent and able enough to exploit it. You might instinctively agree with this. If we have been the only species that has used nature to our advantage, then we should continue to do so. Yet, the same logic could be used to argue that we should be serving nature and not the other way around. Our brilliance has been in our capacity to use nature. Our foolishness has been in the way we have gone about it. The same cleverness that justifies our use of nature also justifies why we need to use our privilege to protect nature now. We are the only species capable of doing so. Do we have a responsibility to nature for its servitude to humanity since the dawn of time, independent of our capacity to help nature? Should the narrative be more about what we as a species owe to nature versus how to sustainably use nature to our advantage? The responses to these questions seem almost instinctual. Not only are we the only species that can help protect nature, but we are the cause for its current predicament. It is a climate emergency that our actions have brought upon us, and at this point, human beings must right their wrongs done unto nature. Our responsibility to nature exists twofold. We have been the cause of nature's decline, and even without its direct cause-effect relationship, we are the only species that has the capability to help nature flourish. As the most intelligent species to colonize the planet, helping nature, or reversing the harm done unto nature, does not necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. Sustainable development is the prime manifestation of humanity's intelligence, both recognizing the limits of nature while also maximizing its utility. With careful planning and calculated decision-making, mankind can both rescue and strike a balance with nature. And our last article, Nature is Kinship and Relationship. And this article was written by David George Haskell. What is nature? Our hands have an answer. Lift yours. Look, a palm, thumb, five fingers. Rub your fingers together and feel the textures of skin. Sniff, a long inhale from the aromas on the back of the hand, then the palm. Listen to the friction of fingers on your earlobes. Taste the salty tang of fingertips. So many sensory impressions, each one speaks of nature. Nature is not something outside ourselves. It is not a wilderness somewhere beyond our homes. Nature isn't an alien or an other. We are nature. This belonging takes many forms. The five digits of our hands and feet contain memories of ancient family history. We inherited our five fingers from the fleshy finned fish that crawled onto land 400 million years ago. Some of these ancestors had seven or eight digits. If they had been the survivors, instead of the five-toed ones, we'd be counting not in decades, but by increments of 14 or 18. Remember that on your decadal birthday. When we see the architecture of our hand, we're seeing that we belong to an ancient family lineage. The plan of our hand also connects us, through the family tree, to other vertebrate land animals, dogs, birds, frogs. We all share a five-fingered blueprint, greatly modified in each branch of the family tree. Our senses also have deep roots and unite us in kinship with other beings. A sense of touch and smell is shared by all life. Even simple single cells can feel physical touch and pick up the chemical aromas of their surroundings. Hearing is more specialized in each part of the family tree. The hair cells that pick up sound in our ears descended from the tiny hairs on the surface of single cells, like the planktonic cells that swim to this day in ocean and pond water. These hair cells also gave rise to our ability to see. The light-sensitive cells in our eyes are modified by hairs, their tips no longer beading, but welcoming light in their protruding arms. We are one part of an amazingly diverse genealogical tree. Part of our nature is to belong to this family. Not all the family members are pleasant. Malarial cells and viruses are our kin too, sickening us as they jump between hosts. Nature's family, just like human families, is not free of danger or disease, but it is our home, our place of origin. Our challenge, then, is to find ways to heal its brokenness and help its vitality and goodness in the future. Flex your hand muscles. Feel the delicious physicality of your fingers, their heft and presence. Here is another part of nature. Every part of us and every motion of our bodies is made from atoms that came from other beings. The oxygen that powers our hands and keeps our consciousness alive came from trees, grasses, and ocean plankton. Every action and thought is made from minerals in soil and the molecules of other animals and plants. Every bite of food is nature. This is true regardless of whether that food came from an industrial supply chain or from a windowsill planter of herbs. Human body, mind, emotion, and action are partly made of trees, ocean, soil, and the many living beings that sustain us. Nature is evolutionary kinship. Nature is the ecological connection that sustains us. Nature is also community. I gaze at my hands and think that I see an individual, a self. But this is an illusion. My skin is partly made of human cells, but also from dozens of species of bacteria. Without them, I'd sicken. The same is true of my gut. This living community is deeper still. The bacterial community of our mothers shaped us in the womb when we were growing embryos. We are walking communities. What seems like an individual body is an intersection of relationships among many species. Our nature, then, is of interconnection. This is true of other species, too. Tree leaves and roots function only through their deep connections to fungi and bacteria. Take away these connections, and the plant withers. Even the microbes that live in the ocean, sometimes millions in a single drop, are networked into community. Each cell specializes on a task that it does best, relying on others for the rest of the essential work needed to stay alive. Nature is relationship. We are made from nature, but nature also far transcends our bodies. Before humans evolved, millions of species lived in the Earth's forests, oceans, rivers, and grasslands. They made these habitats what they are today, building soil, creating richly varied physical spaces, and suffusing the world with nutrients. Hundreds of species live in a single drop of ocean water or scrap of soil. A single tree can host thousands of insect species and dozens of birds. There is more diversity in a small patch of urban parkland than any one person could know in a lifetime. Tens of thousands of bacteria and fungi, hundreds of plants and animals. There's a paradox here. Nature is both about the most intimate kind of belonging and a community whose size and complexity we can never grasp. Nature is both a cozy home and a humbling vastness. Despite the pollution and losses of habitat and species in the last centuries, much of the diversity of the living Earth persists and, if we allow it, will flourish long into the future. Nature is made from interconnection, and so our task is to find how to be productive members of life's community. I suggest that a necessary first step is to recognize that nature isn't some other outside of us. Then we can cultivate relationships in the human and beyond human world, get to know our extended family and community. What species live in our neighborhood? What people, forests, soils, and oceans do we connect with when we eat? What is beautiful and what is broken in these connections? Where might our work be helpful? Out of these lived relationships comes the knowledge of how to act. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.